Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and has been broadcast on community radio stations in Preston, Swindon and St Albans. We're on Bristol Community FM every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com on 93.2 FM. This week, Roland Dye, who's been down at Burfield, where Britain's nuclear bombs are remanufactured. Also, from Dresden in Germany, Volker Reusing. He runs something called Unser Politik blog, and he talks about banks foreclosing on nation states. Never mind if the banks go bankrupt. If the nation states go bankrupt, they're going to snap us up. Also, David Guinness on the former Yugoslavian bliss. And finally, JFK Grassy Knoll assassin James Files, part two of our series with him. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. You can call them on 0117 909 6897 or visit them on the web at prsc.org.uk or in person in Jamaica Street. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show.
I'm Roland Dye. I'm an ex-nuclear scientist, and I had the pleasure of taking part in the beginning of a month-long blockade at Burfield, which is Britain's nuclear bomb factory.
Now, do they actually make nuclear bombs anymore? Surely they're just refurbishing them, Roland?
The factory, which I'll remind your listeners, is 1 mile south of the M4 near Reading, slap bang in the middle of the south of England, which seems a very strange place to put a nuclear bomb factory. After all, they are making nuclear bombs, and we all know what they do. They're reprocessing the old ones. Every nuclear weapon has a limited shelf life due to the radioactive decay.
Okay, how long is that shelf life then?
I don't happen to know. I guess it's a matter of years, but with something like 120 warheads up there stored in Scotland at a base called Coalport, probably more than 120 because they have to have a larger range to pick what they need from, big ones, small ones, fancy ones, I don't know how it all works. There's quite a large stock. They're aging all the time, so they have to be taken apart, remanufactured, and then new ones actually constructed. And already this country is embarking on the Trident replacement program. I mean, though they say that sometime this year, probably in the autumn, there'll be a vote or debate in the House of Commons, they already made the decision in terms of certain infrastructure investments. The multi-million pound laser research facility based in Aldermaston.
How much is the Trident going to cost then?
Well, it started off at a modest sort of 70-odd billion over its lifetime, and the price keeps rising. The latest estimate by CND, National CND, is over 200 billion. I think it's 205 billion pounds. That's the cost of Trident over its entire lifetime. If you write your MP, they'll tell you that the submarines are just costing a mere 30 to 40 billion or something like that. Quite a lot for just four submarines, isn't it? But the entire system, including the warheads and everything, that's over 200 billion. And at a time of austerity, savage cuts in social services, look what's in the pipeline for Bristol over the next few years. I mean, vast, multi-million pound cuts, which will really bite into frontline services. And yet the government's willing to spend that colossal sum of money on this weapon of mass destruction.
Yeah, but the thing is, we still need some kind of... I mean, the Cold War, if anything, is hotting up recently. It's not gone away.
Well, funny you should mention that. Last week, I actually organised a couple of meetings for a guy who's launched a book about Trident and why we don't need it. And he very modestly said he set out, 20 points which are usually argued by politicians why we need Trident. He thought he'd managed to overturn about half of them. He'd be doing well. In fact, in his book, he's managed to overturn all of them. The truth about Trident, just recently produced by a Scottish publisher, his name is Tim Wallace. For example, and this came as a shock to me, have nuclear weapons kept this country safe? Well, didn't stop the Argentinians invading the Falkland Islands. It didn't stop the Suez Canal being taken away from us, though, of course, my views on colonialism. We shouldn't have had it in the first place. It didn't stop Algeria waging a liberation war against France, which is is also nuclear. And once you start to reprocess history, it's not as clear-cut as they would have us believe.
Okay, well, what about the Trident? Is there any kind of real independent nuclear deterrence, or do the Americans have a veto on anything we want to do with these nuclear
weapons? Well, you put your finger on one of the absurdities of Trident. It's the so-called British independent nuclear deterrent. We make the submarines and pay for them. We make the warheads and pay for them and run the risk of them being made in our country. The actual rockets, the propulsion units, I guess we can't manufacture them. They're manufactured by the Americans, and they run on American guidance systems, or those sort of super military GPS systems. So it's a nonsense. Britain would never have an independent foreign policy to the Americans when our nuclear weapons are actually controlled by them.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, we had something called the Black Arrow, which was Britain's intercontinental ballistic missile, which was also possible to use for putting satellites into orbit up until about 1973, which is when the agreement was signed to join the European Union. We signed away the Black Arrow. So that was kind of interesting, I think, you know, in regards to the timing with the EU. Really, Britain gave up its ability to have any kind of independent nuclear deterrent. That's if we wanted one anyway. But look, what's been going on at Burfield?
Right, what's been going on at Burfield? It's actually a month of direct action at Burfield, so it'll be carrying on to Thursday the 30th, which I'll mention in a moment. So I was there, in fact, a minibus of people from Bristol all went over to Reading for a day of workshops and training workshops, trying out new blockading techniques, including giant inflatable cobblestones, as they're called. Anyway, lots of great vitality and ideas, and we got up on the Monday morning and went and closed down the nuclear bomb factory. Now, if there's some hardcore listeners out there who want to boast to their mates, I mean, like, you can't get more interesting than closing down the nuclear bomb factory.
Yeah, but I mean, it's actually quite irresponsible of you, isn't it, to stop the these bombs being maintained. Otherwise, something may go wrong with them.
I'll correct you on that. There are essential staff who have got in, but every time they know that one of these blockades now is over the last 3 years, they've learned that they, you know, when peace activists say they're going to turn up, they do. So it looks like they've changed the entire travel plan for the whole facility, possibly over the month's duration of the program of direct action. So the staff, and there's about 500 of them, instead of driving into work, they had to catch the bus. Well, it'd be very good to raise their consciousness about public transport, wouldn't it? And then have to walk in and having a lot more security checked. So all those workers perhaps might start. And we don't have an argument with workers. Workers do not have a choice, really, about where they work in the end. I mean, we're all wage labour slaves. And their jobs are safe anyway. It would be a very long job to dismantle all the present nuclear weapons and make them safe. But they'll be thinking, well, you know, is there something wrong? The government does so much propaganda about why we need nuclear weapons. They'll be thinking, maybe those peace campaigners have got a point after all.
Now, surely the government, surely the Ministry of Defence Police or whoever it is would just basically stop the blockade. What have you done to actually stop the main entrance to the Burfield?
Well, the campaign is very well organised. It's committed to the principles of non-violence and it's drug and alcohol free. So the cops have learned over the years that no one's going to be unpleasant or cut up rough with them. So it's all done on a sort of very, and I hate to use the word polite, but principled action. There's two techniques, really. I mean, there's publicity-grabbing stunts. So at the main gate, there were people doing media-grabbing stunts, and red is the colour for this year. The red line we must not cross as regards climate change and other major issues like Trident, for example. So really strong, you know, photogenic media stuff coming out from the main gate. Meanwhile, around the back, two teams of people snuck up with lock-on tubes. Those are devices that brave people put their arms in. They can lock across roads, and it's very difficult. It takes hours for the security services to help them out. And by an amazing bit of flexible thinking, those two groups then managed to seize what the large construction gate, we call it, at the back of the nuclear bomb factory. That's where major construction vehicles go in. It's also where the bomb convoys come out. And it'd been rather foolishly left unguarded, and we managed, I think the Guardian claimed that we've set a record now for the longest occupation of a military gate in the country. It actually went on for 11 days. well over a week.
But still, at the end of the day, the decision is going to be made. You've already said it's pretty much already been made. £200 billion to spend on Trident. You're not really going to change anything.
Any government decision can be stopped at some point. Yes, it's complicated. All this stuff is all privatised now. They're letting out contracts to private companies to line their pockets. Makes it vastly more complicated for them, by the way. The number of times these companies actually met up on their contract, not to mention health and safety, it is only a nuclear bomb factory, what is there to worry about? But let's be optimistic. At any point, the government can find ways to stop spending this gigantic sum of money. Now, if you are a listener out there who is an old-age pensioner who might die of hypothermia this winter, somebody who needs hospital care, social services, education, etc., a decent home to live in, what are they going to say? Tell the government to stop throwing this money away on these horrendously awful weapons of mass destruction. Let's spend it on what we need here in society. It's going to make the world a better place, isn't it?
Well, can you just tell us how we can follow some of the stuff you're doing online, websites or campaign groups, that sort of thing?
Wherever you are, check out your local CND group. They've been going for a long time. Their information and literature is excellent, and they all know all about campaigning against nuclear weapons. In terms of direct action, the blockade at Burfield Nuclear Bomb Factory was organised by a group called Trident Ploughshares. Trident, as in the name of the weapon, ploughshares, as the quote from the Bible, they shall convert their swords into ploughshares. That was a memorable name. Great lots of images up there on their website. And Bristol will be going back at the end of this month, Thursday the 30th. So check out their website. There'll be a link to me. We've got a minibus going. Very early start, but you will have an incredible day with incredible people closing down Britain's nuclear bomb factory.
Does Bristol have an active campaign for nuclear disarmament, CND chapter?
Certainly does. They're very busy. And us direct action people are very busy as well. So check all that out on the website and you'll find us.
That was Bristol-based anti-nuclear campaigner Roland Dye.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
I'm Volker Reusing. I'm from Unser Politik blog. It's a non-profit internet blog. We're making interviews and we make articles on Unser Politik blog. We're from Germany. The three main issues here at this conference, I think Bilderberg is mostly about finances, about economics, about foreign and safety policy. So I think it's certainly the Brexit is interesting to them. Also, what they are going to do with Russia and China. And they have a big issue about the America and its debt and what I think when the debt bubble will crash, burst in the USA, I think that's probably an issue there. I think something which now has become very actual, although it is connected more with the Bilderberg Conference 2011, Bilderberg has often invited EU commissioners, and in 2011, the then EU Internet Commissioner, Nelly Kroes, has been there, and one of the issues has been the diffusion of power because of connectivity. And between the Bilderberg Conferences, 2011 and 2012, in January 2012, a draft EU data protection regulation has been introduced. It's with file number 2011/00COD. It's about, it pretends to be about data protection, but it's more about a censorship. If you publish then, after it's enacted, and now it has been enacted, I think it has been in April this year, if you publish something in the internet, if you make an interview, you do not only have to ask the person you make the interview with, and you do not only have to ask the person about whom you publish something in the internet, and it's not only the internet, with all automatic and half-automatic things you use to make an interview. Also, if you print a book or if you make a newspaper, a printed one, then you have also to ask data protection, and I would like to add, and censorship authority, which is under the control in two steps below the EU Commission, not below the national governments. And you have to make an assessment, a data protection assessment. It's really about data protection, but it's also about what will your data protection or your reporting, it's inside the definition of data protection, which effects will it have? And so if you don't make such a data protection impact assessment, or if they think it's not sufficient, they can impose fines up to 20 million euros. And so everyone who publishes something on the internet and whose data protection assessment they do not consider as sufficient, they can impose such a fine, up to 20 million euros. So it will lead, if they, now that it has been concluded, if they really apply it, they can, with only one fine, they can financially ruin every voice that you don't like. Certainly, there are so many things published that couldn't, will never be able to catch anyone, but they will be able to pick out the people they don't like. It's a very existential threat to independent media, but it's also a very existential threat to politicians who are courageous. They can pick out the politicians they like if they run for elections and publish something on the internet. And even if the person they name there say, yes, publish on me what you want, they can say, the data protection authority, where is your data protection impact assessment, and can ruin any political party they want or any politician they want. So it's all in the name of data protection. That is, since April this year, it's a very, very urgent thing to make this well known, also that they don't come through with that. It's very existential. It threatens all independent media. First, they are more endangered than anyone else, but also independent politicians of any color.
Why do you think they're doing that?
I think it's to calm down people who say things that they don't want. And they will silence people who are very courageous, and that to make sure that other people are intimidated.
Now, you know, it sounds to me like a knife in the heart of a free press.
Yes, certainly, certainly. They do it in order to put through certain agendas and to ruin people financially whenever they become too dangerous.
Would you like to speculate on what those agendas are?
Well, if I look at the Bilderberg Conference 2011, one point on their agenda has also been where they have stated more metaphors, but I'm sure that it has focused on the ESM, the so-called European Stability Mechanism. It's a forced mechanism with the Troika, and that mechanism contains a state insolvency procedure. State insolvency procedure, they have hidden it in Article 12, Paragraph 3, ESM Treaty. It's only included that all countries which have the currency euro have to attach to their state debts collective action clauses. And they have not published what is in those collective action clauses, but for the ESM, several laws in Germany have been changed. Also, the law in Germany on the public debt management, in German Bundesschuldenwesengesetz. And into the law on the public debt management, the Bundesschuldenwesengesetz, they have inserted the articles 4a to 4k. And if you read those articles, then you see there's a certain date. And the debts have to be told to a court in Frankfurt. Private creditors have to tell to this court the debts of Germany or the demands they have to Germany at this certain date. And it's like a private insolvency procedure. And then you have assembly of the private creditors, and they can make decisions to change the collective action clauses. So they can say, okay, we reduce the interest rate on the debts, or we reduce the nominal value of the debts, but they want something in exchange. That will be privatization. Where do I know it from? Several persons have said that they want the ESM to speed up privatization. To find, for example, in an article, I think it has been from July or August, of the Deutsche Wirtschaftsnachrichten, where Markus Kerber, who is General Secretary of the big industrial NGO, BDI, Bund Deutscher Industrie, talked about about the ESM and that it should be used to speed up privatization, and that the states should give their property as a security for the event that they go bankrupt.
Many people would say that Greece is insolvent now.
Yeah, the normal thing to do if a state is insolvent is not to make a state insolvency procedure, but that the state is obliged to talk with all its creditors, and then if they don't come to an appointment, then the state has to decide itself, because the state is sovereign. And the standard according to which any state bankruptcy has to be made, the standard are the human rights which are applicable in that state. Of the human rights treaties a state has ratified, and particularly in the national constitution of the respective state. For example, where they wanted to make a global ESM, the debt crisis of Argentina has been the pretext, and where they wanted to fool the people, the countries of the G77, and they have asked for the UN to make a global state insolvency procedure. But then they have been informed what is going on in Europe, and how the people in Europe have been fooled, and that is for total privatization. And then they have concluded something else. At September the 10th of 2015, the states, 136 states, don't want a global ESM, but they have said, okay, if the state and its creditors do not find a compromise, then the state has to decide itself. And they have concluded 8 standards on which to do that. And one standard, at least, is to respect human rights. It means to make the human rights situation not worse than it is before the state bankrupt. That's very protective for the poor and inhabitants and people who need health services. And
if this privatization goes forward, it looks like it may well go forward, who will end up owning what is now our national governments?
Well, the national governments will remain where they are. Also, the parliaments will remain where they are. And the public tasks will remain where they are. But all other tasks will be done by private firms. They have smuggled it into Article 2 of Protocol 26 to the treaties of the EU. Since the Lisbon Treaty, from an EU law perspective, all EU member countries are obliged to even all sovereign tasks by private firms. And they have not done it very far because of the Constitutional Court decision, of the German Constitutional Court decision from June the 30th of 2009, the Lisbon judgment. The Lisbon judgment has said, okay, you can enact the Lisbon Treaty, but only with, they have made a long list of provisions where the limits are of its implementation. And they have prohibited the privatization of police, of military, and also of any civil services which are sovereign. They have prohibited all this privatization of the sovereign tasks, but it's binding only for Germany. And later on, they have made the same constitutional court, but without the relatively courageous Professor Dr. Di Fabio, who has been then the rapporteur in the Lisbon case. He has been more courageous and more for the German basic law. Now we have a very much different direction with Professor Peter Michael Huber as a rapporteur for constitutional complaints with a focus on international law or EU law. And we have a president of the constitutional court who is very much in favor of privatization of sovereign tasks. You find a proof of that. He has spoken at the Vereinigung Deutscher Staatsrechtslehrer. It's a professional association of Jura professors with a focus on state law. He has spoken there in October 2002, and the title of his then speech is Leistungsgrenzen des Verfassungsrechts. It means that you cannot do everything from a constitutional law perspective. And he has made a speech in favor of a privatization, functional privatization of sovereign tasks, to let it be remain sovereign tasks, but to have it done by private firms. And in thesis number 12 of his then speech, he has said that our constitutional order, even from its very basics on, is not open for a mix between a private and sovereign power. He has admitted that it's totally unconstitutional. But then, when we have made the ESM Constitutional Court decision at March the 18th of 2014, then they have said, must add something, what they have done in the Lisbon judgment. They have said that the highest law in Germany is that what is inviolable, where you must not interfere in any way. And inviolable is complete human dignity and other four structural principles: democracy, rule of the law, social state principle, and federalism. And so the most important thing is certainly democracy and human dignity. And when they have made the ESM decision, they have said, okay, we define a core of the core and we only apply in relation to EU law only democracy and the basic right to vote. No human dignity, no life. And also not the prescription which prohibits privatization of a sovereign task. It's also a basic right that this is not allowed. And they have not applied it. And so have waved through the ESM, which also wants the privatization of the sovereign tasks. Without Judge Professor Dr. Di Fabio, they have done that. They have waved it through.
So look, it does sound as if all of our governments around Europe are under threat, maybe except for the German government, because there are some guarantees of non-privatization of the core functions of the government.
Well, in Germany, we have the so-called function reservation. It's a basic right, and which shall protect the people from arbitrariness. And the function reservation means that basically sovereign tasks may only be done by people who have sworn on our basic law and who are directly employed by the state, so that private power and private profit interests are completely out of the execution of sovereign tasks. And this has been included in the basic law very intentionally. We have had very bad experiences in a dictatorship where the government has mixed with IG Farben Corporation. And it's very bad that now, from a neoliberal view, people want to commission private firms with nearly all sovereign tasks. There's also a connection to Bilderberg. Even one can say it's indirect. The president of our Constitutional Court, Professor Dr. Voskuhle, he is not only president of the Constitutional Court, but he also is a juror professor at the University of Freiburg. And there's an NGO which is furthering the work of the University of Freiburg. And there are several prominent people. And among those prominent people is also José Manuel Barroso, who has been the president of the EU Commission during the whole time when these four mechanisms with the Troika have been made, with the ESM as the gravest of them because of the state insolvency procedure, and also Dr. Wolfgang Schäuble, also a Bilderberger, he is now here, and Dr. Wolfgang Schäuble has been at Bilderberg in 2003, I think then at that time regarding inner security, and he is a very important financial minister that these things like ESM have put in place. And my wife, I would like to mention my wife and I, we have made constitutional complaints regarding these things like ESM. Against the third of those mechanisms, it's called EFSF. There's a law in Germany, it has been changed two times. We have made constitutional complaints against all versions of that, and three complaints about ESM, because three laws in Germany have been made for that. One about changing the law on the public debt management, where they have made sure for Germany the state insolvency procedure that is not only in the collective action clauses. And the worst of it is one prescription with only two sentences. The first sentence is about the stability of the euro area as a whole. We have proven that this is only a metaphor for the financial stability of the financial sector. And it means to save the banks. All these mechanisms are made to save the banks, particularly in their role as creditors of the states. And the second sentence of Article 136, paragraph 3, says if financial aids are given in these mechanisms, then they have to be connected to strict obligations. We have looked how strict is this meant, and we have found how strict it is meant. You find it at two places. In one, it's a preamble of EFSF, strict as towards Greece. It's an incentive to be very strict to Greece in order to be able to be very strict to the other countries. And you find it in a statement of the financial and the economical ministers from May the 9th of 2010. They want the conditions which are imposed on the states to be as strict as in the practice of the IMF. You find it as under file number SN2564/1/10. And there you find that statement of them.
So where can we find your work on the internet?
You find it at unser-politikblog, that's our blog. And from there is also a link to the 718 pages main complaint we have made about the ESM. They have not decided on that. One can imagine, because with our complaint they would have had not only to strengthen the human dignity of the German basic law, but also to apply the social human rights we have invoked of the UN Social Pact, and to make that the standard for state bankruptcy and not this completely inhuman strictness of the IMF. So if we go bankrupt, we will feel the strictness of the IMF and not the basic rights and human rights we have. And there are several connections to Bilderberg, particularly regarding Mr. Barroso and Mr. Voskuhle. I also could mention a connection between Dr. Hertha Däubler-Gmelin, who has been at Bilderberg Conference 1989, where they have spoken to about giving sovereignty to the EU by means of a currency or economics, and her connection to Professor Dr. Peter Michael Huber, who have been in the same NGO.
That was Volker Reusing from Unser Politik blog. That's UNSER-POLITIK blog.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
I'm David Guinness. I'm actually an old Etonian, but in 1972 I was a shop steward on the assembly line at Ford's Dagenham. So I know a little bit about, well, in my vocabulary, how the other half lived. Now, I'm basically an engineer, and I worked on the space program in 1968. I went to business school at MIT, which was a quite amazing place. We graded the teachers. And I got interested in cooperatives. And someone said, I think it was the sociology professor. He said, well, if you're interested in cooperatives, go to Yugoslavia. Well, I found out a bit more about Yugoslavia, and I thought, this is the way things should be.
So what year was your visit, and what was Yugoslavia like?
Well, I learned a few words of Serbo-Croat, and I touched down in Yugoslavia in 1969, and I spent a month there. And it was a quite extraordinary place. One of the first things that struck me was that there were no licensing laws for alcohol at all. People could brew their own slivovitz on their farm, and you could get a drink at a kafana at 3 o'clock in the morning. There was that. Now, the rest of it I'd heard about in America. Basically, that Tito was a dictator, and yet, underneath him, Yugoslav citizens lived in an environment of unparalleled freedom.
Well, when you say freedom, what do you mean? There's lots of different ways that word is used, David, isn't there?
Well, freedom at work. It's quite true to say that in Tito's Yugoslavia, the workers could sack their boss. what used to happen was you could employ up to seven people. In a larger enterprise, it was run by an elected workers' council, who in turn appointed the director. And if the director turned out to be unsatisfactory, or the workers' council didn't like him, they could sack him and appoint someone else. So it was genuine industrial democracy. We've heard industrial democracy mean all sorts of things. This was the real thing that happened.
So how did that manifest itself in the way that ordinary Yugoslavs lived their life? I mean, you can contrast that kind of thing to, you know, sort of British version or US or German versions of the way industries work.
Well, I met someone who was a Yugoslav, and he said to me this. He said, you can enter Yugoslavia by seven different countries. Now, I'm not going to remember them all, but there was Greece, there was Italy, there was Albania, there was Romania, and three others. But, he said, people stand straighter in Yugoslavia. Now, to me, that spoke volumes. And there was a sense there that, when I went there, I had two questions. One was, did the system work? And secondly, did the people like it? Well, work, it half did. In 1950, Yugoslavia was a largely peasant population. By the time Tito died, they were making their own cars under license from Fiat and building their own ships under Split. So the system obviously worked.
So when did Tito die, and what led to the breakup of Yugoslavia? Was it just Tito's death?
What happened was...
Can you just start with when the year he died?
Yes. 1980. Tito didn't believe in his own death somehow. So he made no arrangement for his succession at all. So you had the different republics of Yugoslavia, Croatia, Bosnia, Herzegovina, Montenegro. They all wanted to be the boss of Yugoslavia. And that led to a civil war. Now, I suspect at that point that the CIA was involved. If you have a country that's consisting of republics that basically hate each other, it's pretty easy to destabilize it. You just shoot someone and blame it on someone else, and then there's a civil war. Well, that's what happened. And that was the end of, Tito's Yugoslavia. Although, still to this day, you'll see some people having a photograph of Tito up in their shop and saying, Tito, dobro organizasi. Tito had a good organization. So that was basically what happened. Now, all of that, the breakup was public. We all saw it on our television screens. And that's what Yugoslavia gets remembered for. And Tito's Yugoslavia, what happened there, the really good things that happened, you see, it was neither capitalism or Soviet communism. It was something quite new, and it was called worker self-management. And, it was Yugoslav socialism, really.
To what extent is there still some sort of socialism left in that part of the world? Does it still exist?
Very little, as far as I gather. It was, well, actually, there's evidence that I read that it was systematically wiped out by NATO. There was precision bombing took place, and the self-managed enterprises, including the Zastava car factory, were bombed, but the new private enterprises, which were given, were left untouched.
What about your vision of the future of Europe and Yugoslavia particularly? Do you think that there's any real hope that we'll regain some of these happier industries? Because nowadays, you know, a lot of trade unionists across Europe are targeted still. People who try to do organisation within workers often find themselves without a job. We've had a big scandal in Britain over the last couple of years, another one to do with blacklisting, for example, and this surely doesn't foster good industrial relations where trade unionists are being secretly targeted and may lose their job for life.
Yes. Well, what is not very well known is that there are something like 500 businesses in this country that operate on Yugoslav-type systems. There's the two big ones are Essential Trading and Suma Foods. They both have articulated lorries to deliver their produce and employ over 100 people. Now, the problem in this country is that these businesses, these 500 businesses, they operate under a very complicated legal system. Now, France, Germany, Italy, Spain, and many others have their own legal system for a framework in which a cooperative business, as it's called, well, it's some call it workers' control, but I call it a self-managed enterprise, can exist. It has limited liability and this sort of thing. In the UK, we have nothing at all. And what is urgently needed, if businesses like this are to foster, is a body of legislation passed by Parliament so that there will be a proper cooperative, worker cooperative branch of company law.
That was David Guinness talking about the former Yugoslavia and workers' rights.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Finally this week, it's part two of our interview with JFK Grassy Knoll assassin James Files. He was one of the hitmen sent from Chicago down to Dallas on that fateful day by the Mafia.
Okay, so it gets to be, say, Thursday before the assassination. How did it all come down?
That Thursday, I went on back to the motel. I dropped him off that afternoon. I went on back out to the motel to get some rest. And the following morning, I'd gotten a message that I was supposed to call Leo at the, I think it was the Dallas Cabana. And I called over there and answered the phone to Leo because Mr. Nicoletti didn't want his name used. I knew he'd come in late. I didn't know when he come in. I didn't know how he got there. But when I come in, I was told to come over there and park and that Johnny Roselli would come down. He wanted me to drive Johnny Roselli to Fort Worth. I pull up out front and waited. He come down a few minutes after I pulled up. I never went in the hotel, never asked for anybody. He come down and come outside because he knew I was en route. And I drove from there to Fort Worth, Texas with Johnny Roselli in the car.
So that was Mr. Nicoletti went with you?
No, Mr. Nicoletti did not go.
Just Roselli?
Just Johnny Roselli went with me to Fort Worth.
Did you know Johnny Roselli prior to that day?
I had met Johnny Roselli before. I'd met him in Florida, Miami.
Any jobs with him?
Never any jobs with him. I'd talk with him and around, but we never, we were probably involved in some of the same operations or things, but with the same people, but we never went out and did anything together.
Were you aware that Roselli was working with the government in anti-Castro?
Yes, I was well aware of that. He was, I was well aware that Johnny Roselli was involved in the government actions. He was like the liaison between CIA and organized crime, and he was heavily involved in the invasion of Cuba, Bay of Pigs, Chianos Bay, whichever you prefer to call it. But he was also very tight with Frank Sturgis. Frank Sturgis headed up the SAO, which is the secret army organization, what this is all about. And they've had so many different code names for wanting to kill Castro, I couldn't even name half of them. But every time you turned around, somebody had a new operation going. But Jen...
I'm sorry, did you ever hear Mr. Roselli as called colonel, or did he have any military credentials?
I don't remember what the total name was. I know he was called colonel once in a while. I can't remember the name of it. I know he was called colonel. But that was, as far as I know, Johnny Roselli never held any rank of any kind. But, like I say, he was, and Bob Tebler, the CIA, he was liaisons between them. What his actual part was, I don't know, but I know he was heavily involved with them and all through that.
I think it was Ralston, Colonel.
Yeah, Ralston, that's it. Colonel Ralston. That's what they call him, Colonel Ralston.
Okay. So tell us about the trip over to Fort Worth.
The trip over to Fort Worth? Well, I didn't know where we were going to Fort Worth. He's told me, and he had directions, and I don't know if he'd ever been there before or not. But we went through Fort Worth. I remember the exit was, the exit really was like University Avenue or University Boulevard, the name University, that's all I know. And I know it was on the south side, and then it stood on the west side of that street. It was just a couple blocks off, and there was a pancake house, fairly new one.
Did you know it's still there?
No, I didn't know it's still there, but
still there.
It's been there long. I guess they made good pancakes, I know that.
True.
But that's where I had my first Belgium waffle.
Why did you go all the way to Fort Worth?
Excuse me, I got to clarify one thing. I didn't have a Belgian waffle that morning. I had the Belgian waffle there a few years later. But that morning when I got there, Johnny Roselli went there to meet somebody by the name of Jack Ruby. I had never knew Jack Ruby, nothing about him. When I got there and pulled into the parking lot, Johnny Roselli told me, he said, let me go in first, see where I'm going to sit, come in, position yourself. And he asked me, he says, are you carrying? And I said, yeah, I'm carrying. He says, good. He says, when I sit down, where I'm sitting at, he says, I don't know what may transpire. He says, something could go wrong. He said, but be very alert. He said, keep my backside covered. He said, I won't be in your line of fire. And I said, okay, I'll pick a hope and fuel of fire. I says, wherever I figure I can handle it. I said, I'll go sit down. I'll come in position myself. Johnny Roselli went in, and they had like, you call it a booth at the table sitting there, you know, it wasn't bolted to the floor or nothing. But he sat down in that, and I went in shortly right behind him. I positioned myself at the counter, ordered a cup of coffee, was served, and sit there. And then I sit there and I watched until short, stocky built man come in, walked over, Johnny got up, they shook hands, they sit down, they talked for a couple of minutes. I seen him take like a half size, like a legal envelope, but only half that size, out of his jacket, and he laid it, pushed it across the table to Johnny Roselli. He got up, they shook hands. This man left. Johnny waited maybe 2 minutes. Johnny looked at me. I got up. I walked out of the restaurant, made sure the area's clear, nobody outside in the parking lot. I went over, got in the car, started up. I pulled up by the door. Johnny Roselli walked out, got in the car, and we drove away.
Did you ask him, or did you find out in some way what was in the envelope?
On the way back to Dallas, Johnny and me was riding down the road. He didn't open the envelope right away. We got almost, I think it's Arlington. It's about halfway there. I'm saying halfway. It could be less one way or the other. Been a long time for me. But we was right about Arlington. And Johnny opened the envelope up and started taking stuff out and looking at it. And he's looking at it. I'm noticing over. I'm watching over while I'm driving. And he's got these little black wallets, like half-size, like identification wallets. And he opened them up, and there's identification plates in them, and there's badges in them. at that point, I didn't know what the identification on it was, because he's sitting there looking at it, and I'm not going to lead over. I'm not going to say, give me one of those or anything like that. I wait when they want me to know, he'll tell me. And then he opened up a piece of paper and he unfolded it. And there's been a lot of discrepancy over this part now. But Johnny Roselli said they only made one change in the route.
And that was map of the motor.
It was a map of Dealey Plaza, the motor key route. When he looked at it for Dealey Plaza, he said they've only made one alter, one change in it. He said, that's all. And I said, what's that? And he said, they're going to go down Elm Street. So they're going to stop and make a detour and come around this little street here. And he held it up, and I kind of glanced over at it, but I didn't get a chance to look at it real good at that point. But I already had reconned the area, so I knew what he was talking about. And I know everybody says, well, the matter that they had the motorcade in the newspaper weeks and months ahead of time. True, they did, but they didn't have that one change. And anybody who wants to show somebody a newspaper clipping, they better check it real close, because the original route, they was not coming down Elm Street there on that little detour where they had to slow down.
Had you heard prior to that that the when they got to Dealey Plaza that they would just continue straight on down Main Street? Was that the idea?
The original plan was that we'd be shooting at a fast-moving target, and Nicoletti had no military experience, and I already had advised him that he would have to shoot high and the target would be going away from him, that he would have to shoot above the head. And we were going for a headshot, and I told him, it's going to be hard for you to get from there. And we're getting a little bit ahead, though, before we got into this part.
Yeah. Let's go back.
Because Chuck hadn't got to Dallas that week. He only come in, I'd seen him that morning. I hadn't seen Chuck in person until I went with Johnny Roselli to Fort Worth and come back. Johnny Roselli got out of the car, went upstairs, Charles Nicoletti come down. Mr. Nicoletti got in the car with me, and we drove to Dealey Plaza.
All right, back up a half second. How did Roselli get to Dallas?
At that point, Roselli, he mentioned to me, Johnny Roselli, we was on the way to Fort Worth, and I asked him, I said, when did you get in? He said, I got in this morning. He said, I got in early this morning. He said, I hadn't been here a couple hours. And I said, how'd you get in? And he said he got lucky. He caught a ride on a plane that's sponsored by the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA. I said, how the hell did you manage that one? He said, I got lucky. He's had somebody there. I didn't ask no more. He didn't elaborate any more than that. I didn't dig any deeper than that.
He didn't mention the board team at that time.
Not at that point.
Okay.
So we got all that. Now then, when we get back, I still don't know that he's there on an abort mission. I have no knowledge of that at this point of the game. Johnny Roselli got out of the car, went back in the hotel. I waited maybe 5 to 7 minutes for Charles Nicoletti to come down. When he got down, Mr. Nicoletti got in the car with me and said, let's go. We took off. I said, where to? He said, take me over by the plaza. We went over. We parked. It's drizzling rain. We get out. We're walking around. This is the first time that Johnny or that Charles Nicoletti has even mentioned to me about an abort team. And he asked me.
Pretty
while we're walking around, he asked John Charles Nicoletti asked me, he says, how do you feel about being backup? I said, what do you mean backup? He says, how would you feel about being backup as a shooter for me? I said, what happened to Johnny? What's with Johnny? And he said, Johnny's a little bit paranoid on this. He says, the CA's called the hit off. He said, they don't want the hit to go down. And I said, well, what'd you say? Chuck's exact words were, them. It's going anyway. And I told him, I said, what about Johnny? He said, well, Johnny will be with me, he says, but he's not going to be a shooter. He said, he doesn't want to go against the orders. He said, he's been told he flew in here specifically to abort this assassination.
Did he say he got cold feet?
When we was talking, when I asked him about Johnny Roselli, I said, how come Johnny's not going to be a shooter? He said, well, he doesn't want to go against the orders of the CIA. He said, what he wants to say, he wants to call off. He said, he flew in here as an abort team. He said, they flew a plane here specially with him on it to tell us to call it off. And so I asked him at that point, I said, what'd you say? He said, I said, f*** him, it's a go. He said, we're going to do it. He said, Jimmy, he says, you know we can't call this off. Only one man can stop it. He said, and he's here. If he wants us to stop it, he said, he'll notify me. He said, I'm not going on somebody else's word. He said, as poor as it is right now, I have a go. He says, from the boss. He says, we're going.
Now, who was the one man that could have stopped it?
There was only one man. Charles Nicoletti did not say his name at that point. He just said the boss. I knew he was referring to. He was referring to Sam Giancana.
Part two of our interview with James Files, JFK Grassy Knoll assassin, and more from him next week. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokescroft, just off Jamaica Street. You can call them on 0117 909 6897 or visit them on the web at prsc.org.uk or in person in Jamaica Street. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week, goodbye for now.
In the chilly hours and minutes of uncertainty, I want to be in the warm heart of your love and mine. To feel you all around me and to take your hand along the sand. Ah, but I may as well try and catch the wind. When sundown pales the sky, I want to hide a while behind your smile, and everywhere I'd look, your eyes would find. For me to love you now would be the sweetest thing. 'Twould make me sing. Ah, but I may as well try and catch the wind. All my blues behind. For standing in your heart is where I want to be and long to be. Ah, but I may as well try and catch the wind. Try.